Welcome to Brighton Broadcast News for Friday, October 27th, 2023. Mike Adams here. Thank you for joining me. We've got a packed show for you today. We're going to start off with the breaking news that the United States is now, the war in the Middle East is on. The U.S. just launched airstrikes against multiple targets across Syria using F-16 and F-15 warplanes. And these targets are said to be proxies for Iran. And so the U.S., which claims that these were, quote, defensive strikes, you know, self-defense strikes, we defended ourselves so much that we bombed them and destroyed them. This is kind of an insane point of view, but this is obviously designed to provoke Iran. And then, amazingly, in an announcement from Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense, he claims that the United States, quote, does not seek conflict. So it's like, I'm punching you and saying, I'm not punching you, but I'm punching you. And then if you punch back, I'm like, how dare you attack me? You know, that's what this is. This is crazy. So the United States absolutely wants war. And we're going to have some updates here about the carrier strike groups that are being deployed around the world. With two of them, well, the USS Ford, now deployed in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea, and the Dwight D. Eisenhower carrier strike group headed toward the Mediterranean Sea, but apparently being now tasked with CENTCOM, which is a central command position, not quite in the Mediterranean Sea, but close enough. Now, we're going to have a featured interview today that you will find fascinating. It's the perfect fit for today's topic. And I'm interviewing author, analyst, former Soviet Union naval technician, by the way, but an American for over 35 years, I believe, Andrei Martynov. And Andrei was kind enough to join me for his analysis on Ukraine and Russia, the Middle East in particular, but also some exotic weapon systems. We talk about hypersonic missiles, we talk about drones, we talk about carriers and so on, and also the miscalculations that we both think are taking place with the United States and Israel, and the lack of industrial munition production capability across the West, not just the United States, but also Europe. In any case, you don't want to miss that interview. And Andrei Martynov, if I get that right, he is the author of a book called Disintegration, Indicators of the Coming American Collapse. And that's published in 2021. You can find that all over, you know, Amazon and other booksellers, Barnes & Noble and so on. Just search for Disintegration by Andrei, A-N-D-R-E-I, Martynov, M-A-R-T-Y-A-N-O-V, if you want to find that book. Anyway, he'll be joining me here relatively soon. Now, I need to apologize to Andy Scheckman because I'm delaying running my interview with Andy. We're going to delay that, frankly, because the U.S. launched these strikes on Syria today. And that necessitated me running this interview with Andrei, who is a military, you know, quite a bit of a military expert. I mean, he served in the Soviet Union military before the Soviet collapse. So he's also a very brilliant person. High IQ, has a lot of understanding that he will share with us. So you don't want to miss that, especially if you want to know where things are going in the Middle East. Now, in terms of the situation involving Gaza and Israel, so far now over 7,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli airstrikes since October 7. And remember that about 1,400 Israelis were killed in the Hamas attacks on Israel. So now the number of Palestinians who have been killed is quite a multiple of that. The United Nations is going to have an emergency meeting sometime today, and they're supposed to vote on a resolution that has been drafted by Jordan. And this resolution, I believe, will call for a ceasefire, but Russia had already put in similar resolutions, and they were, well, both of them, two of them, were vetoed by the United States. So the U.S. does not want a ceasefire. The U.S. does not want peace at all. And what I think is happening, which is exactly what I've been covering here for a couple of weeks now, is that the U.S. wants war with Iran, and is willing to sacrifice Israel to make that happen. Just like the U.S. is willing to sacrifice Ukraine to go to war with Russia. I mean, it's so clear. It's so clear. It's very easy to see this. It's I don't know how anybody can miss it. So let's get back to the airstrikes in Syria. I mean, this is the U.S. now attacking Syria. And it says it's doing so in retaliation for the attacks on U.S. military bases in Syria by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or the RGC, which is, of course, Iran or Iranian, the IRGC, as it's called. And it begs the question, a lot of people are asking this question, why does the U.S. have a military base in Syria? Yeah, that's a really good question, especially since the government of Syria has demanded that the U.S. leave and shut down its military base for many years. Because I thought the U.S. evacuated the whole area, you know, with running away in Afghanistan. I thought ISIS was no longer an active issue, at least, you know, not publicly and admittedly. So why does the U.S. have this base in Syria? And the answer is the U.S. is the occupying, you know, global hegemonic military dictatorship force that wants to have a military base in every country and, you know, rule the world. That's the answer. And so in response to the U.S. support for Israel and Israel's continued bombardment of civilians, Palestinian civilians in Gaza, combined with Israel's siege of cutting off water, electricity, fuel, and so on, and food, U.S. military bases have been getting attacked around the region. There have been a couple dozen injuries, nothing major, but there are some, you know, drone attacks, essentially, on U.S. military bases. So it's reported now that U.S. forces carried out airstrikes against the Iran-linked militants and installations in eastern Syria. So Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin said these attacks took place and they were carried out by U.S. warplanes that were probably launched maybe from the USS Ford. It's not actually clear where they were launched from, but they were F-16s and F-15s used to strike targets in Syria. And we also have an announcement from CBS News that says 900 additional U.S. troops have been deployed or are in the process of deploying in order to run the missile defense in CENTCOM, which is Central Command, to run the Patriot missile systems, the THAAD, the THAAD, and Avenger batteries. And quote, this comes as Iranian-backed groups continue to attack U.S. military in Iraq and Syria. and the U.S. is bombing targets in Syria. She forgot to mention that. Now, there is a heightening of the rhetoric between Iran and Israel and even the United States. We saw Iran's foreign minister say some rather blunt things over the last few days. Now, Hossein Salami, the commander-in-chief of Iran's elite Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, has said that if Israel attacks Gaza with ground forces, that the IDF will be, quote, buried. He says, if the Zionists launch a ground attack in Gaza, they will be buried. If the enemies think that the Muslims will watch these crimes from the sidelines, they are gravely mistaken. He says also that the U.S. will be buried by the fire they lit. Another statement from the IRGC says, quote, if the evil people of the world want to carry out a foolish act, such as invading the Palestinian territories, they will face a miserable failure and receive a decisive response from the resistance front. And don't forget the comments yesterday from Erdogan in Turkey, well, 2 days ago, saying that if Israel attacks Gaza, that Turkey will have to get involved in a military way in order to stop Israel. And no doubt the Syrian government is probably on the verge of issuing some kind of similar statements if they have not already. So we are seeing now Turkey, Syria, and Iran are absolutely preparing to attack Israel and the United States assets in the region, which include, of course, the USS Ford and the Eisenhower Carrier Strike Group. So this is a gathering for war. Clearly, these are not little defensive maneuvers. This is not designed to de-escalate. This is all escalation. And let's talk about the U.S. strike carrier groups. In fact, there are four U.S. strike carrier groups that are deployed right now in the seas around the world. The USS Ford, as you know, is in the East Mediterranean Sea right now, very close to Israel. The Dwight D. Eisenhower is in kind of the Eastern Atlantic. You have the Reagan carrier strike group near, I guess you could say it's near the Philippines at the moment, and Vinson carrier strike group, which is in the mid-Pacific at the moment. You can see this for yourself, by the way, in real time. If you go to news.usni.org, you can follow the USNI News Fleet and Marine Tracker, and it shows you the real-time positions. You got to wonder, like, how is this okay with the Navy? But shows you the real-time positions of all the carrier strike groups as they are cruising around the world. And there are, you know, 11 in existence in the United States Navy. And a couple of them are docked right now for maintenance, and a couple others are running drills and so on. But there are four groups that are actively sailing the seas, and two that are very close to Israel at the moment. The question is, will the Reagan or the Vinson be redirected to also support the Ford and the Eisenhower? And if so, that would mean that there would be four carrier strike groups headed for the Middle East if that happens. And that would be unprecedented. That would be a concentration of naval warfare forces on planet Earth that has never been witnessed before in the history of known civilization. And that would pose a significant threat to Iran, which is obviously the whole point here. But it would make four carrier strike groups vulnerable to Iran's rather competent missiles, including hypersonic missiles and what we believe are possession of nuclear weapons as well. And make no mistake, by the way, that what's happening in Israel has, from the U.S. point of view, it has always been about Iran. Now, if you're Israeli, you might be more focused, obviously, on Gaza and Hamas at the moment. But the United States is actually looking at Iran and using Israel to be able to justify an attack on Iran. And that's why the U.S. just launched airstrikes in Syria in order to provoke Iran. And part of the goal of the United States military, the Pentagon, is to use U.S. soldiers as bait and then to see some of them get killed by Iran, and then to claim that Iran is now attacking America, and then therefore we have to attack Iran, and to probably justify launching, I don't know, perhaps. I mean, at some point this whole thing goes nuclear. That's clear. I still think that Israel is the first to launch nuclear weapons, but once they do, all bets are off, and then Iran starts launching nukes, and then probably America starts launching nukes, and then Russia starts launching nukes. And the question is, you know, at what point, I mean, how many carrier strike groups are destroyed? How much radiation is unleashed across Iran or other parts of the Middle East? You know, how many millions of people die? I mean, these are the kinds of questions that we're dealing with right now. Can Israel even survive as a nation? And increasingly, it is looking a lot less likely that Israel will survive this. Unless there's a de-escalation. If this continues to escalate, I don't see a pathway for Israel's continued existence much longer. I really don't. Now, in addition to that, the U.S. Navy has become a lot more incompetent than what my perception was. And I've learned this from several key people recently, people, contacts, of course, that I have in military circles, people who are in the know. And this is going to be a delicate little issue. Let's see how I can handle this. But affirmative action is so bad in the United States Navy that you now have people running ships. I mean, you've people running groups, people running, I don't know what you call them, departments within ships and so on, who are absolutely incompetent, not qualified, but they were put into those positions because they checked the right check boxes. They're not the most qualified people. And this is a problem that's known across the military. I mean, how do you think Lloyd Austin got to be the Secretary of Defense, you know? And I just want to be clear. In my mind, I don't care what a person's, you know, skin color is. I don't care what their religion is. I don't care what their gender is or their country of origin. I want the most qualified person, period, to do the job. And that's why my own company is successful, by the way. Because if you were to look at our payroll, you would see we are a very, quote, diverse company in terms of just having all kinds of different people, different backgrounds, and so on. Because I picked the most qualified people. But the U.S. military does not. They pick affirmative action people. And as a result, I'm sorry to say it this way, because, you know, there are plenty of highly capable people of all kinds of colors and, you know, sexes and persuasions and so on. But the people running the U.S. Navy right now are not very competent. And as a result, they will crater under pressure. Now, don't get me wrong. An aircraft carrier is a formidable power. The U.S. Navy is by far the most powerful Navy on the planet. No one can go up against the U.S. Navy ship to ship and defeat it. But that's not what this battle is. This is not a battle in the South Pacific in World War II. This is a land war in the Middle East. And the Navy can only do so much against the land, you know, land forces. Now, as we've just seen, they can launch F-16s and F-15s and they can bomb targets. But then they have to go back to the aircraft carrier and land and refuel and maintenance and all that and rearm. Unless you put boots on the ground, you can't actually defeat an enemy and take territory, which means that the ability of the U.S. Navy, even though it is a formidable force, the ability of it to actually change the course of this war in the Middle East is rather limited. Yeah, you can bomb targets, but at some point, you know, some of your aircraft start to get taken out. And at some point, Israel gets overrun by potentially millions of combat troops from other nations, potentially including Iran at some point. And I don't know what 2,000 U.S. Marines are going to do against, you know, 2 million Iranian fighters. They're not going to do anything because they're outnumbered 1,000 to 1. You're not going to do jack. You know, you're going to get back on your inflatable boats and you're going to flee back to your ships as quickly as possible. That's what you're going to do because that's all you can do. Even a Navy SEAL can't fight 1,000 men, you know? So even though this is the largest naval presence in history, in one place, in the Middle East, it's also the first affirmative action Navy. And I guess we're going to see how that goes. Because that is not the strongest Navy that we could deploy. If it were the strongest Navy, it would not be, again, it wouldn't be based on affirmative action. It would be based on who can do the job the best, regardless of who they are or what they look like. And like I said, that's not who's in charge. Now, Russia has a new super weapon. It's an air-to-air missile. It's relatively new. I mean, it's not brand new, but it's called the R-37M. It's a long-range air-to-air missile with a range of about 400 kilometers. I asked Andre about this in our interview, so you get to hear his response about it. But this R-37M travels at, I believe, Mach 5 or Mach 6, something like that. And it's now being reported that since about the middle of October, that there has been shot down over Ukraine 17 MiG-29 fighters that are run by Ukraine, 17 of them, 2 Ukrainian tactical bombers, 3 Ukrainian close air support jets, 1 fighter jet trainer. That would suck to get shot down as you're training in a trainer jet. And then 3 Mi-8 transport helicopters. It's 26 air assets that have been shot down in about, you know, 9 or 10 days, something like that. This is being characterized as a catastrophic loss of air assets for the Ukrainian Air Force. I didn't think the Ukrainian Air Force had that much left, actually. So I'm surprised they even had 17 MiG-29s. I guess not anymore. But here's the thing. The R-37M long-range air-to-air missile has about twice the range of Western missiles that are air-to-air. And what this means is that Russian fighter jets can back away, stand off over 200 kilometers, and they can identify, you know, Western air asset targets, Western, you know, MiGs or F-16s or whatever they may be, even, you know, AWACS type of planes. They can be identified from over 200 kilometers away. And then the Russians can do a fire and forget, launch the missile, fly away. The missile does its own thing from that point forward. And it can track and destroy a target over 400 kilometers away. This means that the F-35 has just been nullified. The F-35, which is supposed to be, you know, the brand new, the super newfangled stealth fighter. It does everything. It does laundry. It does dishes, you know, and it drops bombs. This is supposed to do everything, has just been nullified because the F-35 doesn't have air-to-air missiles with any kind of range that approaches 400 kilometers, not even close. Again, only about half that. And the stealth factors of the F-35 don't work all the time. You know, stealth aircraft don't just vanish from radar, especially with advanced radar that the Russians have. Stealth are just a little more difficult to detect, but they're not invisible, by the way. That's a big myth. So they can be tracked. They can be seen. They can even be optically tracked, by the way, just visually tracked. You don't even need radar. If you can see it, you know, you can hit it with a missile. And so it brings up the obvious question, if the U.S. continues to bomb Iran with F-16s and other aircraft, it's pretty clear that Russia is going to come to the aid of Iran. And by the way, China just announced they're going to defend Iran. That's another, you know, big, massive bombshell piece of news right there. But if Russia decides to come to the aid of Iran, then Russia would just fly its fighter jets in Iranian airspace or near that and just look for, you know, Western fighter jets coming within 400 kilometers and just, you know, take them out with these R-37Ms. And that would include the kind of F-16s that just drop bombs in Syria. So you can see that this conflict is absolutely escalating and that Russia and Iran have very sophisticated weapon systems. Iran even has very sophisticated anti-air defense systems, you know, anti-ballistic missile systems, while itself possessing a very advanced, you know, targeted guided ballistic missile systems, or I guess that might sound contradictory. I mean, medium range, nuclear capable guided missile systems is what I mean. So there are all these assets and all these countries are just ready to deploy them. Everybody wants to punch, you know, the go button. Itchy trigger fingers all over the Middle East does not look good. Iran's foreign minister has accused the U.S. of, quote, managing the genocide in Palestine. This is just another example of how this war between the U.S. and Iran is heating up. Headline from RT in this case, the U.S. will not be spared if Israel-Hamas war escalates, says Iran. And this comes from a statement of Iranian foreign minister, who we've quoted for several days here. This guy, he's got a mouth on him. That's for sure. Hossein Amir Abdollahian, I think that's it. Speaking to the UN General Assembly, he says, I say frankly to the American statesmen and military forces who are now managing the genocide in Palestine that we do not welcome the expansion of the war in this region. But I warn, he says, that if the genocide in Gaza continues, they will not be spared from this fire. He's talking about the U.S. This is our home, and West Asia is our region. We do not compromise with any party and any side and have no reservations when it comes to our home's security. And then he said this over the weekend. Quote, it's a great shame that the American president announced that the U.S. would dispatch hundreds of planes, ships, and trucks filled with military equipment to the occupied territories to support the mass murder that Israel is committing in Gaza. but has managed to coordinate plans for only 20 trucks carrying humanitarian aid to enter the besieged enclave. That's, again, Amir Abdollahian. And he says, if the U.S. and the Israeli regime do not stop their crimes against humanity immediately, there will be a possibility of anything at any moment, and the region may spin out of control. That's some pretty hot talk right there. Now, you may have seen in the last day or so, there was a story that claimed that the Israeli forces, in conjunction with U.S. Special Forces, were going to drop nerve gas into the Hamas tunnels. This story, by the way, originated with Middle East Eye, which is at MiddleEastEye.net. And it's a site I was not aware of until just recently because of the situation in the Middle East. But David Hurst is the author of this. I think he's also the publisher. And he says that Palestinian groups expect Israel to flood Hamas tunnels with a type of nerve gas or chemical weapon under the surveillance of U.S. Delta Force commandos as part of a surprise attack on the Gaza Strip. Okay. Says a senior Arab source familiar with the Palestinian groups. That's the source of this article. I want you to know I have not covered this. I've decided not to run an article about this because there's something to me that is fishy about this claim. And, you know, the source is, okay, like a high-level Palestinian guy, let's say, who says he thinks that Israel and the U.S. are going to drop nerve gas in the tunnels. Well, it claimed to be based on a leak from the U.S. military. This story claims that the nerve gas would be some kind of a knockout gas, essentially, that would, quote, paralyze the bodily movement for a period of time between 6 and 12 hours. And then during this time that IDF forces would go in and they would rescue the hostages, you know, the Israeli hostages that are still being held, and they would kill Hamas while they're sleeping, I guess. This strikes me, this claim that you can pump tunnels full of knockout gas and then rescue hostages after they've been knocked out by this gas and so on, this struck me as not credible. So that's why I decided to pass on this story. I just wanted you to know why I have not covered it. And the reason I'm asking this question, now, I may be wrong. Maybe this is perfectly legit. Maybe there is a leaked thing about this. I'm not attacking anybody over this. I'm just saying that in my discernment, as the editor of Natural News, I decided that this story did not seem credible to me. And here's why. Because if, first of all, I mean, we're talking about anesthesia or some kind of nerve gas. And typically nerve gas means a fatal gas that kills people. So this isn't really nerve gas. This is an anesthesia gas. And anesthesia gas has to be administered at very specific doses based on the person's body weight and also their physiological responses that are carefully monitored. If you've ever undergone surgery, right, you have an anesthesiologist there whose job it is essentially to make sure you don't die because they're kind of taking you close to death with the anesthesia. I mean, you're losing consciousness. You're kind of almost nearly dead, but then they bring you back. And that margin of error of how much anesthesia you can handle versus how much would kill you, it's not a super wide margin. And the thing is, you can't just willy-nilly throw gas into tunnels and you can't have any idea how much people are breathing in. And so if you were to do this kind of thing, you'd probably end up just killing everybody, including the hostages. And so this did not strike me as a credible story. Now, to its credit, the Middle East Eye website did say in its article, quote, Middle East Eye cannot independently verify the information in this leak. So they're just saying that, look, this is what we were told. We can't independently verify it. Kind of do with it what you think. I don't find it credible. No. And, you know, in addition, nerve gas that kills people is banned under, you know, international war conventions. I don't know the precise citation of chapter and verse on this, but I'm sure, you know, Dr. Francis Boyle would know. But I don't think you can use nerve gas and claim to be the good guys these days. But then again, you're also not supposed to bomb civilians and cut off their food and water. And Israel is definitely doing that. So there are no good guys at the moment, it seems. There are only victims and evil governments. I mean, that's where we are. Also, there was a so-called mass shooting, which was covered yesterday by a lot of outlets. I have learned to never cover mass shootings on the day that the shootings happen because, well, the story always changes very quickly. You know, sometimes the entire race of the shooter changes. Like, it'll start out being like a Hispanic guy, and then on CNN, it becomes a white guy. You know, it's like, how'd that happen? Well, Photoshop. You know, suddenly it's a white Hispanic shooter. Well, that's how it'll be reported sometimes. You know, pretty wild. Or a white Asian shooter. It's always white, no matter, even if they start out as black, it'll be like a white black person shot up the mall or whatever. I mean, it's crazy. But anyway, this mass shooting was apparently carried out as, anyway, it's being reported. This was in Maine. An Army reservist who was also a firearms instructor killed, I believe, 18 people, wounded several more. This has all the earmarks of MK Ultra. This is a wind-up Jason Bourne scenario on steroids. And right on cue, the White House is calling for a ban on so-called assault weapons and, quote, high-capacity magazines. Which, as you know, when they say high-capacity magazines, they actually mean normal-capacity magazines, which for an AR-15 is a 30-round mag. That's a normal, everyday magazine. That's not a high-capacity. High-capacity would be like a 100-round drum or something, and no serious tactical person runs around with a 100-round drum on their AR-15. It gets in the way. It gets caught on everything. It doesn't feed reliably, by the way. That's why when you see soldiers in the field and you look at their chest rigs, they have 30-round mags in their chest rigs. Sometimes, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 of them. They don't have 100-round drums hanging off their chest. It would also make it impossible to climb over obstacles, by the way. And I don't know if you've ever tried to lay down in, you know, in the prone position and fire your rifle while you have a chest rig full of magazines, but it gets pretty bulky at some point. You're like, whoa, I can't even get to the ground. Sometimes you want to get low, for example, when you're under fire. But anyway, that's beside the point. So right on cue, the White House is saying, take all the guns. And then Vice President Kamala Harris wants to, she's calling for nationwide firearms confiscation. She said that gun violence has terrorized and traumatized so many of our communities in this country. Notice she says gun violence. That's a dishonest term. Guns don't commit violence. People do. And let us be clear, she says, it does not have to be this way, as our friends in Australia have demonstrated. She's talking about Australia confiscating 650,000 guns from law-abiding citizens, by the way. And you know what? If you want to end violence in the world, call for a ceasefire in Gaza, huh? In the Middle East, call for a ceasefire. There is so much more violence. I mean, mass shooting is one thing, 18 people died, but in one day in Gaza, 700 Palestinians died. You want to end violence? Stop the bombing. Call for peace. Engage diplomacy. But you don't see the White House doing that. In fact, the White House is vetoing ceasefire resolutions that have been submitted to the UN by countries like Russia. So, you know, you can't stand there as a White House spokesperson and claim that you're trying to stop violence. No, you're just trying to take people's guns away so that the government can enslave everybody. It's so obvious. By the way, Israel's energy minister, his name is Israel Katz. He actually told Bild, the German publication. He said that the IDF is the, quote, most moral military in the world. They are humane. The most moral in the world. So if you were wondering how moral it is, to bomb 3,000 children to death and to bomb civilians, women, children, hospital patients, newborn babies in incubators and all that. If you're wondering how humane that is, don't worry. It's being done by the most moral military in the world. So it has to be moral, right? It's got to be moral. I mean, an Israeli told us so. And if you disagree with that, you're obviously an anti-Semite, obviously, right? It's got to be moral. So if you want to kill people and have it be moral, just join the IDF. And, you know, speaking of joining the IDF, I think Ben Shapiro should join the IDF. Here's a story that claims, this is from the Daily Bell, claims that Ben Shapiro is on Mossad's payroll. Former Breitbart colleague, quote, "I saw Ben Shapiro receive tasking from Israeli intelligence." This comes from Charles Johnson, formerly of Breitbart News. And Breitbart News now resembles essentially the Israeli propaganda ministry of truth at this point, where he worked in the early 2010s era alongside Ben Shapiro. And he posted on Twitter a few days ago, quote, "I want to be fully on the record that I saw Ben Shapiro receive tasking from Israeli intelligence connected to Netanyahu when I worked next to him at Breitbart.com. When I asked him about it, he said he always kept close ties. It's time for Ben to register under FARA, F-A-R-A. That's the Foreign, what is it, the Foreign Relations Act. So there you go. And this article on the Daily Mail says, Ben Shapiro has never seen a war he didn't want to start in the service of furthering Israel's geopolitical interests in the Middle East, and has consistently been the loudest voice in the mainstream media, cynically conflating criticism of the Israeli state with anti-Semitism. So Ben Shapiro plays the anti-Semitism card constantly. Oh, you can't disagree with me. You're an anti-Semite, right? I mean, he used to win debates using his mind. Now he just uses the anti-Semitism card. Now, switching gears, here's some positive news. And this is something that I actually predicted quite a while back. The New York Supreme Court has now ordered all government employees of New York City who were fired for being unvaccinated. They are reinstated with back pay for all the time that they did not work. So this is 1,700 employees who were fired for being unvaccinated after the city adopted a vaccine mandate. Many of those were police officers and firefighters. And now they are getting back pay and they're getting reinstated. So they just got, you know, like a 1 year vacation or so, or whatever, however long it's been since they were fired. And I actually predicted this was going to happen also in certain hospitals as well. The court found Monday, and this is from Fox News, that, quote, "being vaccinated does not prevent an individual from contracting or transmitting COVID-19. Yeah, it doesn't. So how can you mandate something that doesn't work? And anyway, the court found that you can't. So, oh, by the way, I want to remind you that in 1967, Israel attacked the USS Liberty and murdered 34 American sailors and injured 174. Israel tried to sink the ship, but Israel failed. And Israel did that on purpose. They knew it was an American ship. They wanted to sink it because the ship was gathering intelligence of Israel's war crimes that were taking place then against, well, Egypt and other parties. And this was all covered up by the United States government. Dr. Francis Boyle was involved in some of the litigation years later. And even to this day, those sailors have not received compensation for their injuries for the war crimes that were committed against them by the nation of Israel. And I have posted on my channel on brighteon.com, by the way, I posted a little documentary on that. Let's see, it's called The Day Israel Attacked America. So you can go to my channel, or you can search for that on brighteon.com, The Day Israel Attacked America, and you can watch that documentary yourself, and you can see what that's all about. It's shocking how many things we're finding out now about, you know, the history of all of this that no one was aware of, or at least I wasn't aware of this. until current events got set into motion. Now, in other news, this is good news from the expose, Italy becomes first nation to ban Bill Gates' fake meat due to, quote, serious health concerns. So this is actually by Baxter Dimitri for the People's Voice. Health Minister Orazio Schillaci announced, quote, Italy is the first nation to say no to synthetic food, to so-called synthetic meat. It does so with a formal and official act. The resolution calls for a commitment to ban the production, marketing, and import of synthetic foods within our territory. This is pretty awesome. I love this. It means if you want real food in Europe, you're going to have to go to Italy. It's a real spaghetti. It's a rotolini. It's not Bill Gates, a fake food. It's a real food with the real sauces, the real tomatoes. That's my Italian accent for the day. I'm going to catch hell from the Italians. And then in other news, this was covered by Jonathan Turley, Oregon schools eliminate proficiency requirements in math and English for students. So they have dropped any kind of proficiency in math and English. You don't have to be able to do any math at all to graduate from high school in Oregon. And you also don't have to know how to read or speak. And I was just thinking, this is awesome. They must be preparing people to join the woke Navy and to run the naval vessels. Yeah, if you can't do math, you're perfect for that because you can just make ships run into other ships. You can't calculate, you know, nautical miles or, you know, speeds and vectors in the ocean, compass directions. It's awesome. Are you from Oregon, sailor? You moron? Yes, sir. I'm from Oregon, sir. Sailor, what is 2 + 2? Sir, 5, sir. You get the job. Would you like to run a destroyer? How about a cruiser? Would you like to launch missiles? Yes, sir. Sir, yes, sir. Sailor, you are a complete freaking retard. Sir, yes, sir. That's what qualifies me to be a leader in the United States Navy, sir. Now, before my veteran friends get pissed off at me, I have to qualify this. I'm talking about the youth that are now joining the Navy. I have many friends who are veterans of the United States Navy who are perfectly capable. They're the older guys and gals typically, and they knew what they were doing. And you know, if you're a veteran of the Navy, you know exactly what I'm talking about. You had to do your job. You had to know what you were doing. You had to be competent. You had to make do. You had to improvise. Today's youth coming into the Navy, they can't do squat. They don't know what they're doing. And again, the failure of the public education system is creating a failed military system. And this is proof of it now in Oregon. You don't even have to be able to do math. And by the way, what does Oregon say is their reason for not having any proficiency requirements in math? Because they say it's unfair to students of color. Unfair to students of color. They're saying, I mean, are you kidding me? It's unfair to require black kids to be able to do math. Isn't that belief kind of racist? Isn't that kind of derogatory towards black kids? To say, I mean, you have the state of Oregon saying, well, these kids are too stupid to do math, and so we're going to drop the requirement. Instead of saying, why don't we do a better job teaching math? You know? I mean, that would be the obvious solution to this. If you got a group of students that can't do math, find a better way to teach them. Because believe me, there are plenty of people of all kinds of skin colors that are highly capable of doing all kinds of math. And some of the greatest mathematicians in the history of the world, by the way, were, for example, Indian people or Middle Eastern people, for that matter. And some have been black people as well. So, you know, I mean, this is just bonkers. But what else would you expect from Oregon, the state where you're not even allowed to pump your own gasoline because they think everybody's too stupid to pump gas? And they banned pumping gas for like 30 years. I think they just recently lifted that ban because they decided that maybe Oregonians have learned how to pump gas at the gas pump. So I think they've lifted that law right now. But for all these decades, it was illegal to pump your own gas, believe it or not. Yeah. A lot of you know this if you ever visited Oregon and you tried to pump your own gas. You're like, oh, no, you can't pump your own gas. We have to pump your gas. What do you mean? What do you mean you have to pump my gas? Well, state law, sir, state law, we have to pump your gas. You know, says this low IQ idiot who probably can't do math, right? So like he can pump your gas, but you, even if you have a PhD, you're not allowed to, you know? Amazing. By the way, when you stop requiring black students to pass math tests, then this ripples, you know, downstream through the education system where, you know, at some point these black students graduate from high school unable to do math, and then they apply for college and the colleges accept them, and then they get into college classes and the college professors realize, holy cow, these people can't even do math. So what happens? The colleges have to then drop the requirements. Like, oh, now you can get a college degree. You don't actually have to do any math. I mean, you might study economics in college. You might study, I don't know, engineering or physics or chemistry or something, things that require mathematics, but you don't have the math background because the high school slacked off, because the state slacked off. But then what are you going to do? Well, I guess you drop all proficiency requirements. It's just rubber stamping degrees. Yeah, you're an engineer. Go out and design bridges, you know? Bridges that will fall down, obviously. Go out and design missile systems for the Navy. Sir, yes, sir. 2 + 2 = 5. I mean, the only targets that the Navy missiles could hit are, you know, of course, commercial airliners like TWA Flight 800. Okay, bad satire. I apologize for that one. Yeah, I actually admire the men and women of the Navy that do their jobs, by the way. I do. I don't mean to give them a hard time here. And the history of the Navy in terms of defending America in World War II is extraordinary. And you got to admit, it takes some real balls to get on a submarine and go underwater for long-term deployments, you know, 6 weeks or more, and to live without seeing the sun, no horizon, no sky. I mean, that is mentally brutal. And then knowing that the hull could fail at any moment, or you could be hit with, you know, depth charges and die drowning in a metal hull, you know, surrounded by your colleagues who can't help you. I mean, that takes some balls to do that. And so I do want to honor the naval veterans. I mean, I know I'm making fun of the failed education system here, but I do want to really legitimately honor our naval veterans and our military veterans who have fought for us and sacrificed so much over the years. And that's why America is worth defending. You know, a lot of people fought to get us to some point of basic liberties and basic prosperity. And now it's all being, you know, thrown away. It's being flushed away. And that's what's frustrating to me about it. And when you see our education system failing and our military failing, it's very disheartening. I actually love mathematics, by the way. It was a very strong subject of mine in, well, all my schooling and college as well. That's why I have a minor in economics. I don't know if you knew that. But it also, of course, has helped me tremendously in the food science laboratory that we now run. And because, I mean, when I first had to learn how to run a mass spec instrument, I mean, I started from zero knowledge. And I hired a PhD to come in and help me. I mean, we started out with the basics, like how do you make a series of dilution standards, you know, external standards, and you take these known concentration standards and then you use pipettes and you dilute them. And, you know, you have to know what you're doing with the milliliters and microliters and you know, doing the math and what are the concentrations. You know, how many micrograms per milliliter, for example, is this standard? And you have to be accurate with it. And I had never even used pipettes at first. You know, I didn't know what vortexing was, you know, to mix up vials. And so I didn't know any of it. It was like on day one, I remember he was telling me, he was like, you got to make, you know, this is a 100 parts per million solution here. And you got to make, you know, got to dilute it to 10 parts per million and 1 part per million and then 0.1 parts per million. And I'm like, okay, so what, how do we know what this is? And he says, well, you know, 100 parts per million is 100 micrograms per milliliter. And I'm like, why is 1 microgram per milliliter the same as 1 ppm? Shouldn't it be 1 microgram per liter? Like, why is it a milliliter? Why is it 1/1000th of a liter? Because a microgram is 1/1000th of a gram, right? So, I mean, those are the kinds of questions I had on day one. He's like, dude, just look it up. 1 ppm is 1 microgram per milliliter, not per liter. I'm like, okay, I believe you. I'm just wondering, like, who came up with that? Why are we starting there? And anyway, you tell this was an interesting process. And of course, myself, having been educated in the American school system, where we never used SI units, you know, it wasn't metric. And so, but now today, you know, it's just like second nature vocabulary, you know, talking about all the mass over volume units and everything, unit conversions in the lab, programming spreadsheets to calculate concentrations, stuff like that. So anyway, I love math, and I love the fact that pi, if you plot it out in a circle, it forms these amazing patterns. I don't know if have you ever seen that before? Let me see if I can show you. I'm going to play a video for you here, about a 1 minute video. This shows what happens when you plot prime numbers and approximations of pi on a polar plot, which is a radial plot. You get a very interesting pattern and then a pattern within a pattern. It's rather mystifying. Check out this video.
Now, if you make the admittedly arbitrary move to knock out everything except the prime numbers, it initially looks quite random. After all, primes are famous for their chaotic and difficult to predict behavior. But when you zoom out, what you start to see are these very clear galactic-seeming spirals. And what's weird is some of the arms seem to be missing. And zooming out even further, those spirals give way to a different pattern. These many different outward-pointing rays. And those rays seem to mostly come in clumps of four, but there's the occasional gap, like a comb missing its teeth. The question for you and me, naturally, is what on earth is going on here? Where do these spirals come from? And why do we instead get straight lines at this larger scale?
All right, hope you enjoyed that video. A little bit of nerdy math stuff for you. Now we're going to go into the interview with Andrei Martynov, which I'm sure he's pretty good at math too, by the way, so this should be fascinating. Real quick, plug in our online store, healthrangerstore.com. We are seeing quite an uptick in orders of survival and preparedness items now, just suddenly, probably because of what's happening in the Middle East. A lot of people are picking up our new iodine, which is a certified organic glycerin, iodine infused in that glycerin. That's available now. And we also have the regular alcohol iodine. It's nascent iodine in both cases. So you can find that at healthrangerstore.com. We've got mega buckets, mini buckets, and ranger buckets with lab-tested certified organic food to help you through the chaos that's coming. And remember our slogan, healing the world through clean food. And that's what we believe in, and that's what we're happy to provide. And if you're looking for garden seeds, check out arkseedkits.com. That's A-R-K, like Noah's Ark. It actually stands for Agricultural Resource Kit, A-R-K, arkseedkits.com. And they've got heirloom seeds, non-GMO, all kinds of varieties, priced very nicely for the incredible selection that you get. I know we're headed into the fall and winter here in the Northern Hemisphere, but spring isn't that far away. And given where things are headed right now, it's not a bad idea to be able to grow your own food come early next year. In addition, in terms of preparedness, check out BeReady123.com with their solar generators, you know, the solar panels, the charge controllers, the all-in-one kits to help keep you online. even when the power grid fails. BeReady123.com. And then if you're ready for body armor, keep it legal. Obviously, it's not legal in New York, I believe. But check your local laws. HoplightArmor.com, H-O-P-L-I-T-E, HoplightArmor.com. USA engineered by people who can do math, and USA manufactured also by people who are very good at chemistry. And these are top-notch, top quality. These are the plates that I own and use. This is what I would recommend to anybody who wants the protection of ballistic plates. So with that said, let's go into the interview with Andre here, and you're going to learn a lot. I certainly did. Enjoy. And I will have special updates for you of one kind or another over the weekend. And I've got other bombshell interviews to release next week, including an interview with Michael Yon, another interview with Andy Shekman, and an interview with a former Ukrainian scientist on the subject of the Grand Solar Minimum. Those three interviews have already been recorded. I'll be releasing them next week, so stay tuned. Thank you for listening. Welcome to today's interview on Brighteon.com. I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon, and today we're joined by a first-time guest here, but someone who has done many hundreds of hours of outstanding geopolitical analysis, including the war between Ukraine and Russia, and also, of course, now what's happening in the Middle East with Israel and Hamas and the Palestinians. His name is Andrei Marcionov, and he joins us now for, I think, an analysis that you won't want to miss. Welcome to the show, Andre. It's an honor to have you on today, and I greatly appreciate the analysis you've offered the world over the last several years.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, you are someone who you must be conducting in-depth research many, many hours of the day because you have your finger on the pulse of almost everything happening geopolitically. What is your background that you could share with us before I begin with the other questions?
Well, my background is pretty simple. I'm a former Soviet naval officer. I graduated Naval Academy in Baku, which is Captain Red Banner Academy. It's defunct now, obviously. And in 1985, I graduated and went to serve on the surface ships. And in 1990s, basically, I was done with service because of the issues with the stomach. Well, I had ulcers. There's no secret about that. And they said, yeah, you cannot go to sea anymore. So I ended up doing some staff work as one of the flag specialists of the separate brigade. And then, of course, Soviet Union collapsed. I was thrown out of the service. And then later we, you know, already in civilian capacity, we immigrated to the United States because basically I took part in the events in the Caucasus in the, well, it's connected with what is Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. And since then, yeah, we've been living in the United States for quite some time now. Well, three decades almost. So,
wow.
I'm almost kind of native now.
Yes, yes. Okay. Well, that's a fascinating background, and it really gives you this international perspective. That's why I think your commentary on the situation in Ukraine has been so enlightening to so many of us. I want to give out your channel name as well. SmoothieX12 is the name of your channel. People can search for Reminiscence of the Future to find you on various platforms, but if they want to go to you directly, it's smoothiex12.blogspot.com, correct?
Yep.
All right. Outstanding. Let me ask you actually first about Ukraine. In your analysis, we still hear Western media and Western leaders living in what I would describe as a fairy tale delusion of thinking that they're going to make gains and defeat Russia and take back Donbass and take back Crimea. How crazy is that in your opinion, or do you disagree with me?
No, I agree with you completely. It is crazy, but it is also the part of what I've been writing my books for many years now. It's the fact that basically United States in its current state cannot do strategy. they love to use all those big words, but in reality, they are utterly incompetent and illiterate. And when you look, especially in terms of how they miscalculated, because they don't know Russia, but, and again, American academia is, and especially what it's called the Russian study field, it's a wasteland, basically. It's a combination of shysters, self-proclaimed experts, but most of them have zero background in real practical geopolitics, and of course, they don't understand what modern real economy and modern militaries are. You just cannot get this education in any Ivy League school in there. Nothing wrong with liberal arts, make no mistake. I mean, it's just that you, if you have a degree in political science, especially from American university, you will be basically primarily in the darkness and in this delusion of the American exceptionalism. And the issue, of course, that they are miscalculated yet again. And they thought that, you know, they can use Ukraine as RAM, but they don't understand that the size of Russian economy, this Russian military potential. And as a result, we have this, basically we observe what we observe today. And we're looking at the catastrophic failure of the primarily American, well, we say NATO, but it's primarily American because NATO is United States. Without United States, there is no NATO. Right. And the failure of their not only strategic, but also operational planning, because they have no skills, they don't have knowledge in terms of finding real combined arms war of this scale, what is called multi-domain war. And yeah, they've been graduating, all of them primarily, you know, their school of the advanced military studies called, you know, Top Gun Maverick. They live in Hollywood and nothing you can do about it, which is the scariest part, that you have many American military so-called professionals, those generals, those, you know, colonels, they have no clue what they're dealing with.
Well, I also noticed that they appear to be living in 1992. Now, the recent speech by Joe Biden really just recycled all the tropes of the Gulf War, that America is the indispensable nation, that whatever America wants to do with its military might must be dominant in the world, that all of America's enemies are incompetent and have no training, no arms whatsoever. And it appears to me, you know, here we are 30 years later and everything has flipped. And I want you to know that, you know, those of us who were born as Americans, many of us realize that what you are saying about American leadership is absolutely correct. They are illiterate, and I know you don't use that term in a flippant, insulting kind of way. It's
a
description.
I mean it literally, illiterate.
Exactly.
Yes.
They are illiterate. They don't know history. They certainly don't know Eastern Europe or Russia or even the history of the Soviet Union, nor the history of America, by the way. You know, they don't know the history of anything, but they still think they're stuck in 1992. And you use the term miscalculation. What will be the end result of this miscalculation on the part of the West and the U.S. State Department in particular?
You know, I obviously hate to give forecasts. I've never been into the business of forecasting things, although those forecasts sometimes come up as a natural, you know, flow of the thought, so to speak. I wrote the third book, the latest book, which came out in 2021, which is called Disintegration, where I discuss the possibility of a United States disintegrating as the nation per se, as people, because obviously we already have regionalization in the United States along their, well, regional lines. You know, there is a uber liberal coastal cities on the American Northeast or on basically Eastern seaboard. There is obviously Western part of it. There is a heartland, which is absolutely incompatible in their outlook on life. And of course, we have South and Texas and, you know, things of this nature. California is not even America anymore. I don't even know how to judge California, how to assess it. I mean, there's literally, it's not an American state as I remember it. So it is a possibility, but generally speaking, we already observed this basically process. We are in the middle of it. It's the parting of the combined West as the dominant force. Eventually, United States probably will enclose itself in the Western Hemisphere, while Europe, well, economically, Europe is nothing what they tell us about the G7. Same goes for the United States. So economically, Europe is, how to put it, they have been deindustrializing as fast as the United States, and we can observe it now on the example of Germany. So basically, Europe will become, which is becoming, basically a peninsula of the large Eurasian continental mass, which drives now economic, scientific, and other developments in the world. And so that's what it's going to be.
Well, I'm really glad you mentioned that, because it's extraordinary how Russia has reinvigorated its industrial base, especially since being cut off from the SWIFT economic system and the theft of hundreds of billions of dollars of Russian assets that were held in Western currencies. But instead of weakening and destroying Russia, which, again, that's what the United States has been doing for generations, to say, economic sanctions cast upon you, we shall destroy you unless you do what we say. But this time, Russia said, oh, well, we'll just invest in our own country. And Russia's military output now, in terms of drones, tanks, artillery rounds, even to some extent ships, but certainly aircraft, and the technological superiority of hypersonic missiles, anti-air defense systems, ICBMs, hyperglide vehicles, all of these examples, by any honest comparison, it's the U.S. that has been left in the dark ages with very little industry, very little military technology, but a lot of propaganda and boasting and money printing. But you can't print artillery rounds. So, I mean, as an American myself, and I love my country, don't get me wrong, and I'm a Texan, I love my country, but I am astonished at the incompetence of my country's leaders. They have put us in a situation that seems fatal for America. What are your thoughts?
I actually agree with you completely. And again, as I already stated, when you look at the American military history, of course, you have to keep in mind, which I warned for the last 10 years nonstop, rewriting the history of the World War II will do no good. It's not only about the issue of the what we would define as the stolen valor. And nobody takes anything away from the heroism of the Western Allied soldiers, sailors, especially glorious history of the U.S. Navy, you know. So that's not about it. It's about the fact that people evidently lost, which is the direct result of the neoliberal outlook on the gross domestic product by those Chicago, you know, economists and London School of Economics. Those people completely lost touch with the economic reality of the world. And then suddenly they recognize that actually iPhones are not necessarily the most technologically advanced things. Spaceships are, but I mean, and so when you look at this and you have people who come out again as the Ivy League and other universities, they go out from those economic faculties or departments with the education economics. And as Michael Hudson, one of the greatest economic brains of our time, says, they don't teach economy, real economics, in American universities. They don't also teach physics as the separate subject in depth in the American public schools, you know, bar some private schools which do deal with that. They don't teach real mathematics. Oregon yesterday, Oregon, it's our neighbors, you know, to the south from Washington. They basically repeated their policy that students do not have to basically confirm their knowledge at the exams, at the test, in reading, mathematics, and what have you.
It's absolutely extraordinary. Yeah. I mean, you cannot have a sustainable nation if you don't have an education system that functions. And it's just been watered down again and again. But because of that lack of education, we now have leaders in America who say things like what Janet Yellen recently said when she was asked, can America afford a two-front war? She said, oh, certainly. Yes, of course. We can just print money for a two-front war. And I suppose the answer is the same on a three-front war. Well, why not? Do I hear four? Can you give me five? You know, we can just print. And they believe this. That's the thing. And yet, I would argue we can't afford a single front war because we're broke. We can't even protect our own border, much less Ukraine's border. so to speak, or Israel's border, which we're going to talk about, or Taiwan's border. We can't protect our own border. We're broke. It's already done.
Again, yeah, that's when you judge everything by what used to be the mighty dollar. Many people do not understand what good your money is if you cannot buy anything with them.
Right.
And of course, to understand that, you go to any nearest Walmart, and it's all pretty much made in China or elsewhere, not in the United States. And that's the whole idea. They think, look at these numbers of the finances, of the money mass, so to speak, financial mass, and they think, oh, we have a great economy. No, you don't.
Right.
And that's the problem. Yes, the United States still retains some very important strategic industries which are world class. For example, obviously, even today, Boeing fights, for its survival. And let me tell you, if not for this snafu with them, obviously, 737 MAX, which is of course main cash cow, but long range wide body aircraft by Boeing are still outstanding aircraft. They are really good. Okay, so they are extremely competitive. But the point is, when you have even the U.S. Navy and U.S. Military Industrial Complex, which cannot come up with their real decent frigate, and they have to go to Fincantieri, granted Fincantieri has one of its ship wharves in Wisconsin, but I mean, it's an Italian firm which developed together with the Europeans the Fram class frigates. And the United States has to go and literally contract out for the frigate. They couldn't develop the normal frigate for the U.S. Navy, which objectively, they are real workhorses of the modern navies. And even then, they come up with an incredible price tag, no matter how you put it. So, yes, we have the situation that they think that everything is measured in pure dollar mass. It's not. It never was, actually. And in the end, yes, you suddenly recognize many people do not understand Russia, who has less than 50% population of the United States, produces the same amount of steel.
Yes.
It produces seven times more aluminum. And when you look at those real output numbers on which our livelihood depends, not to mention the fact that Russia now is number one exporter of grain and other food stuff, and people still don't get it. I mean,
no, but when it's, you graduated, there's a level of delusional thinking in the West where I saw a Bloomberg report the other day that said that in order to achieve a net zero economy, which they mean no carbon emissions, that it would require $21 trillion of investment in electrical infrastructure and nearly tripling copper mining to 13 million tons per year. And Bloomberg failed to point out that the West cut off Russia from the exports of aluminum and copper and fertilizer and, of course, the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline, necessary for natural gas to fulfill the industrial capacity of Western Europe. And so, I mean, this net zero economy is a pipe dream unless you have raw materials. And even then, in only to mine copper, you have to burn diesel. I mean, you can't mine minerals without burning diesel. So these people are living in a fantasy land.
They are. I mean, first, all this net zero, global warming, and things of this nature. I mean, there is no doubt that there is a climate change, but it's not anthropological. It's not human driven. It's just natural cycle of basically Earth, Sun, and our larger space environment, which influences all that. But we have to understand this fraud starting from this creep, basically, let's put it this way, Al Gore with this baloney which he presented and got Nobel Prize for it, which is completely discredited, basically award anymore. And it is fraud. There's a lot of money in it. It is a fraud driven by people who actually never studied physics. They never got their proper degrees. And of course, we now talk about utter corruption of the not only the political and economic so-called sciences. That is a well-known fact. We're talking about the corruption of the what would come to the STEM or hard sciences. And when you have the physicists who are ready to compromise with their integrity, their consciousness, their academic standing, just writing basically garbage about their anthropogenic global warming, which is being not denied. It was scientifically debunked by number of people inside the United States, let alone, for example, they have to go to people who actually have an incredible experience with this science. And those are Russians. They were actually one of the first to put their weather satellite on there. And of course, United States is not even in the same league in terms of the studying the Arctic as Russians do. Correct, and Russians openly, including Russian Academy of Science, say it's not anthropogenic, it's natural. We have a minimal impact on that. So basically we are talking about the pure scientific fraud, which is done for their whatever monetary gain.
Yes.
And people go for it.
It's incredible. It's really incredible. And it's, as I mean, I'm a scientist myself. I'm a published scientist. I own a mass spec laboratory, food science lab, and I'm astonished as well. You know, I mean, I let the instrument tell me what reality is.
Yeah.
I don't pre-decide what I want and then twist the instrument to produce the results, which is how climate change now works. But okay, quick note to the audience. We had a little glitch there, so I'm re-asking a question that got lost. So, Andre, I wanted to mention that in America, we have the media pushing ethnic hatred at a level that I've never seen before. It's almost like a form of psychological terrorism against the American people. And the government pushes this ethnic hatred as well. And there are two examples that are worth mentioning here. Number one, right after the special military operation began in 2022, everyone was told to hate all Russian people. And it wasn't just to hate Russians in the Russian military or to hate Putin himself. It was hatred directed at Russian artists, Russian race car drivers, Russian sports figures. I was astonished as someone who's very international myself. You know, I speak different languages. I've traveled. I've lived in other countries. I couldn't believe the level of hatred directed to non-military Russian civilians and Russian immigrants to Europe and the United States. And then the other example right now is now Palestinians. You're supposed to hate all Palestinians. You're supposed to say that they're all animals. They're all dirty dogs and everything, which is incredible racism. But we're seeing those two things right now. And it is acceptable in American media to hate, at the moment, Russians and Palestinians. What is your response to that?
Well, my response to that is very simple. Do not forget that this Russophobia was always present among the what is called elite, quote unquote, circles in the West. And don't forget Russiagate. And don't forget when James Clapper in 2018 started that Russians are genetically predispositioned to penetrate, to coerce and things of this nature. So, hey, James Clapper, you know, he says that Russians genetically are, you know, damaged people. So this is as far as it can go now. Well, short of the, you know, praising the SS butcher in Canadian parliament, but yeah, it's becomes absolutely normal for the US media, especially, and you have to understand who those US media are primarily. Most of the main corporate media in the United States, those people who work there, and especially they are kind of leading, so to speak, anchors and what they call thinkers. There are no thinkers in New York Times or anywhere there.
Right.
They are basically stooges who share the same, you know, hatred. And then, of course, we shouldn't forget Mr. Mearsheimer and Mr. Walt with their Israel lobby. And that actually practically most of the American mainstream media are controlled by people of, well, they're Jews primarily, but they are people who are AIPAC connected and neocons by definition. Not all Jews are neocons.
Right.
You know.
Well, right. And so, just not all Jews are Zionists.
Exactly. There are many Jews. I have many wonderful Jewish friends who are absolutely not Zionists and one of the best people I knew in my life. So that's the point. But basically what you have in the American corporate media circle are not only they are stupid and they are shysters, but they primarily are people with the neocon inclinations. And many of them are just downright Zionists. So, and many of them are what, like Mr. Blinken, for example, they bear with them also hatred of Russians.
It's extraordinary.
So it's a very complex issue, which has a lot to do with their, basically what would amount to the Jewish immigration from Russian Empire and their constant desire to settle the accounts. But again, they were always like this, and it's nothing really surprising. So now, Russians kind of fade away a little bit because the war there is lost militarily. It's going to be lost politically. And now, guess what? We have the Palestinians. So all of them are bad in accordance to them, you know. And so the fact that...
This is my... I apologize, but this is my next question. Just as the West grossly miscalculated through their own arrogance and incompetence, they miscalculated their strength in Ukraine, and they miscalculated the resolve and the technical capabilities of the Russian military, do you believe that they are also grossly miscalculating the situation in Israel versus Gaza right now, and especially the Arab nations' response?
Absolutely. And it's not only Arab nations. We have to keep in mind that Israeli lobby, which you can see it's, you know, in APAC, American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, or like, I call it Political Action Committee because that's what it is, essentially. And we have, of course, the Christian Zionists, which is altogether a thing which defies imagination. They are, you know, they have issues with Iran. Let's keep this in mind. Their late war criminal John McCain, his buddy who is still around, and mentally unstable Lindsey Graham, John Bolton, people of this nature, by the way, who are not Jews at all. I mean, but they are Zionists and they are neocons. It's also about Iran. And we can sit here and basically discuss all kinds of the possibilities with how the crisis unfolded, granted that Hamas definitely went on the offensive, so to speak, including some things which they shouldn't have done. And I'm never going to be whitewashing the pure terrorist act of taking the civilian hostages.
Sure.
Taking civilian hostages is a terrorism. But the point is they did miscalculate. They did miscalculate in terms of the efficiency of the Hamas missile strikes or rocket strikes, if you wish. They overestimated their own capability, and now it's all about Iran too, in the United States for sure.
Well, since you brought up Iran, which I'm glad you did, I wanted to ask you about that, but it's my analysis, and I've interviewed many, many people, former high-level military operatives, Defense Intelligence Agency, you know, my contacts go into a lot of, you know, U.S. military and special forces and so on, and what they are telling me is that the U.S. is desperately trying to engineer a situation where they can not only justify bombing Iran, but they want to ensnare Russia into a two-front war, which I find almost hilarious because America is the country that can't afford a two-front war. If anybody could handle a two-front war, it would be Russia or China right now. So it's like, the U.S. is saying, oh, we caught you. And Russia is saying, no, we're not caught. You caught yourself. But this is the current thinking, to try to bring Russia into the Middle East. Do you think the U.S. is going to be successful in that?
No. First, when you talk to most, not all, U.S. military professionals about war, their imagination and experiences do not extend beyond their two things, either their ground, high intensity police action, which essentially the Afghanistan was. It wasn't the combined arms warfare. It was just basically a high intensity police action or bombing something by the standoff weapons or using US Air Force. That's about it.
Yeah.
That's their extent and understanding of the war. What they do not understand that United States cannot fight, obviously, Iran on the ground. It just simply can't. And secondly, Iran has an absolutely astonishing number of very good and very advanced ballistic missiles, or theater-wide ballistic missiles, operational tactical, with the ranges up to actually 2,500 kilometers.
Wow.
And that means once the United States starts doing stupid things against Iran, their bases, all U.S. bases in the Middle East, will burn. As it happened with that in 2020, after Trump, on his orders, General Soleimani has been assassinated.
Right.
And the United States doesn't have a defense, really. I mean, it's no American system can intercept modern missile, such as, for example, again, Iran has an astonishing variety and number of those missiles.
Well, the U.S. is currently deploying the THAAD, the Theater High Altitude, THAAD,
yeah,
right?
THAAD, yeah.
But I get the feeling, I don't know, I don't have any specific technical success rates on this, but given all the propaganda surrounding the Patriot missile battery system that mostly failed, I tend to think that the THAAD systems are also mostly going to fail. And by the way, I also think that a lot of these systems, let's be honest, are engineered by Americans who can't do math. I mean, that's just the honest answer. They can't do math. They don't understand engineering. I'm sorry to say this, but our culture has become so lazy and apathetic in academia that they just can't do math, basic math. If they could do math, they wouldn't be talking about climate change. But that's my opinion as an American.
Well, no, it's a correct opinion. Now, do not forget THAAD. The theater high altitude ballistic interceptors have been already basically disclosed about its inability to do anything when a few years back when Mr. Trump was trying to move things, you know, around North Korea, and Koreans actually launched a couple of the ballistic missiles, as usually they do towards Japan, but they fall obviously short because they are not trying to hit Japan. They merely want to demonstrate it. And it, I believe it at that time, was it Mark Mullen, the Admiral Mark Mullen, who was asked, why didn't you use THAAD or Aegis, SM-3 missiles on the Aegis-equipped destroyers? And he said, not to get ourselves embarrassed, I'm quoting, because basically they might not work and we will kind of expose how not ineffective those systems are. So they were afraid to even, try to take them out. And again, 2020 retaliation by Iran on the two American bases in the Middle East. I mean, they had their Patriots, they had their THAAD, they did nothing. Every single missile warhead hit those bases.
Well, you know what? The U.S. Navy is very effective at shooting down commercial airliners like TWA Flight 800.
Well, I mean,
as long as it's a slow-moving fat target in the sky, they can get it.
Well, they can get it, and again, they can get some cruise missiles, such as they intercept periodically by Houthis. But then again, those are really ancient subsonic missiles. Provided to Houthi rebels by Iran, obviously. So it's, I don't think so. Any modern Navy, Western Navy, has the capacity to intercept a salvo of supersonic anti-shipping missiles.
Right.
I'm talking about salvo, and let alone hypersonic, but we're not going there even, it's... Yeah.
Well, I do have a hypersonic question for you, though, about the relatively new air-to-air Russian hypersonic missiles that are being credited, as I understand it right now, is shooting down quite a number of Ukrainian fighters and helicopters and so on. And these, I think these are is it 37Ms or I'm not sure.
R-37.
And as I understand it, they fly at Mach 6, and they have a range of 400 kilometers, which seems extraordinary for air-to-air. Go ahead. What do you know about that weapon system?
Well, no, it's been already battle-tested. It's shot down a number of the Ukrainian aircraft. But what is most important, it has to be understood that what Russians do militarily in special military operation is, as Mr. Gerasimov, the chief of the general staff, or Mr. Rutskoy, the chief of the main operational directorate, they shape Russian military to, you know, meet the challenges which will be extending to 2050. Even beyond that. And of course, you see the new weapon systems, and R-37 have been in use now for quite some time. What was actually more interesting in the last week, when Russians within a week shut down, I believe, 12 fixed-wing aircraft and several helicopters.
Yes.
All was done by S-400 at the extreme distances and using the targeting from the A-50U, AVACS, Russian AVACS. So that means you literally have the air defense complex, which shot down the low-flying, those aircraft, Ukrainian aircraft usually fly at the height of altitude of 1,000 meters, not to be, they think they are not going to be seen. Uh-huh. So it's 3,000 feet, roughly. So, and that is in itself astonishing. And that's even more impressive, actually, than R-37, because at least R-37, you have the combat aircraft, which is movable, highly maneuverable, and they receive the targeting from, including the AVACS and all other kinds of means of their recon. ISR complex, intelligence surveillance reconnaissance. And we are looking right now at the first serious multi-domain use of the net-centric warfare. And the last week is even more impressive than actually R-37, which kind of by now everybody knows, it's gonna get, it's a shoot and forget missile. That means what? You just get your blimp or blip on the, you know, your multifunctional display screen and, you know, just shoot it.
And it also, it brings into question then the effectiveness of the F-35, which already has a tremendous number of problems, viability issues, parts, supply chain, electronics. Also, Russia is known to be very strong in electronic warfare that may interfere with F-35s. But with these R-37, this long-range standoff capability air-to-air, it really brings into question whether the U.S. can establish air dominance over any theater of war in which Russia is operating, which brings us back to the Middle East. You know, if the U.S. thinks they're going to go in there with F-35s and just dominate all the battlefield, it seems like they're miscalculating on that again.
No, they will dominate battlefield around Gaza Strip,
sure.
No doubt about it.
Yeah.
But when you go to Iran is one of the only five entities in the world which produces all naturally long-range air defense complexes. They say they are Bavar air defense complex, which kind of has their some features from the S-300, but they say it's better than the earlier versions of S-300, and by far. And you know what? I won't dismiss that. So they have an enormously sophisticated air defense system. So, and you know, so, yeah, it the whole idea, again, the whole SEAD, what they call it, suppression of the enemy air defense. United States Air Force never encountered serious enemy air defense, uh-huh. except when it encountered in Vietnam. Well, that ended up really badly for the U.S. Air Force, losing more than 10,000 aircraft, among them 2,500, of course, the fixed-wing aircraft in the Vietnam. And actually, then Israelis learned the hard lesson during the 1973, when they lost within a couple of weeks 130, I believe, combat aircraft from the Russian supplied air defense complexes. They did really well on the ground, but in the air, it was a tough going. Now, again, going back to the issue of the Gulf War, Iraq at that time, Saddam's Iraq, didn't have any viable air defense. It was ancient, and I mean, yeah, if they think that they can, you know, basically shoot a bunch of the Tomahawks, sure, but that's about it.
Right.
I don't think so. Any U.S. aircraft, including F-35, want to go into the battlefield and into the very challenging environment which the enemy will have in terms of electronic warfare and advanced air defense systems, which see everything. They see everything, modern weapons systems. They see any kind of stealth. They see whatever. And that's the whole thing, you know, because,
yes.
I mean, what are you going to do?
Well, this reminds me of the deploying the M1 Abrams into Ukraine. You know, for the longest time, the U.S. said, well, we can't give you Abrams. And then at some point, okay, we'll give you Abrams, but you can't really use them in battle. And I know the reason, because blown up Abrams is not going to be good for selling more Abrams tanks to other buyers around the world. But this gets me to one of my last questions. We only have a few minutes left, but drones. So Iran produces drones. And Russia produces drones, and I think Russia buys drones from Iran as well. And
no, many, Russia doesn't.
No, they don't buy them. Oh, okay.
Iran.
So, but
it's
Russia
a
has
complete fantasy. They were provided. Russians were provided with number of the like small couple dozen of the drones for Russians to look at them.
I see.
You know.
Okay,
so,
but Russia has the Landsat 3 drones, which Kalashnikov, I believe, is the manufacturer and designer of those, and those have
Zala,
been
Zala, yeah, subdivision of Kalashnikov. It's
Kalashnikov.
Called Zala.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you for the correction. But that is a game changer in the theater of war. And the Lancet 3s, as I understand it, have taken out some Leopard 2 tanks, but even when not doing that, they're taking out guns, artillery units, and so on. And here again, yeah, the U.S. military seems to be really lagging behind in terms of drone development technology. And I'm, as an American taxpayer, I'm wondering, wait a second, we're funding our military with $1 trillion a year, very, very close to that, and our weapons are still stuck in 1995. Like, what's going on here? Talk about drones.
By the way,
yes.
Yeah, by the way, today yet another two Leopard 2s have been blown up by Russians. It's all over the news, including
Is
videos.
It? Wow.
So, yeah, it's... Again, it's modern warfare. So this is what I, again, in 2019, I published the book, which is called Real Revolution in Military Affairs. It's also on Amazon. And I basically described in detail what's going to happen. And it's happening right now. And again, as I already stated, they do not understand what Russian industrial, not potential, industry is and industrial capabilities. It's massive. And so, yeah, the Lancet drone is just part of it. There are many other things. And it is confirmed now that Su-57s do fly in pairs with S-70 Ochotnik, the Hunter, the state-of-the-art heavy drone. That's stealthy, and you probably saw it. It's a flying wing type thing. And yeah, we, as I already stated, when the hostilities will wind down, it will be very interesting to get some hands on some at least available information and combat statistics.
Yes.
But what is already known also, their air defense efficiency is just absolutely astounding.
And one more question along those lines. I mean, we've been talking about weapons, but there is also an economic asymmetry in the cost of producing these systems. That's very important to point out. And I saw research on 155 artillery rounds that says that the United States spends upwards of about $6,000 per round to produce these. And those are not exotic rounds, just kind of standard, normal explosive rounds. But Russia can produce the same round, as I understand, for about one-tenth that cost. And so
yes.
Russia has an economic advantage. And I would think a similar situation exists in Iran, where Iran can produce military weapons at a fraction of the cost of the U.S. So for those people who are saying, well, the U.S. has the biggest military budget in the world, which it does by far, but is it 90% waste? You know, kickbacks, inefficiency, incompetence, you know, why does it cost the U.S. or all the above? Go ahead.
All the above. Yeah, all the above. Although I would say people as already coming back to the same issue of the real economics. Just to give you an example, Russia already operates 6 state-of-the-art Barry-class strategic missile submarines, especially Barry-A class, which is the improved. They are state-of-the-art, and each sub is around $1 billion. Just to give you an example, Columbia-class U.S. Navy future strategic missile submarine, it's around $9 billion a hull. So basically, for the cost of one American strategic missile submarine, Russians basically renewed their naval strategic missile deterrent.
Wow!
And those submarines, especially Barrier class, are state of the art, one of the most silent submarines nowadays. In fact, this I understand. For example, that United States needs to indeed kind of renew its deterrent. It's normal thing under present condition of humanity, you know. So the problem is, I mean, $9 billion, I mean, it's just unbelievable. Single sub.
Well, but according to Janet Yellen, they can print whatever money they need forever for multi-front
Janet
wars.
Yellen doesn't understand real economy. That's the problem.
That's for sure.
United States is the biggest exporter of the inflation. But the moment countries begin to kind of limit their operations in dollars, the inflation, which is already happening as we speak, is going to be coming back to the United States.
Yeah. Well, and the horrifying thing is that if you put Janet Yellen in charge of the Pentagon and Lloyd Austin in charge of the Treasury, there would be no difference in outcome.
No difference.
Because none of them know what they're doing anyway. Any final thoughts before we wrap this up?
Oh, no, what can I say? I mean, it was my first time at your show, and I really am grateful that you guys invited me. So, and I hope that basically we're going to live through this incredible time. This is nothing. I thought Soviet Union collapse was huge, and it was, make no mistake. But this is something else altogether. It's a completely different level of what we're observing now.
Wow. Yeah, well said. I agree with you, and I want to thank you for taking the time with us today. Andrei Marcianov, folks, and his website or his channel name is SmoothieX12, and you can go to smoothiex12.blogspot.com or check out his books. One of them is, give us the series. You have 3 so far?
Yeah, I'm writing the 4th one.
Okay, what are the 3?
Yeah, it's you can easily find them. Starting from the losing military supremacy, and you can see them all. I have my evidently they opened as they usually do for the authors, published authors. I have the kind of small page dedicated to me.
Okay.
So they can go to Amazon. Okay, can go to my publisher, people who publish me, which is Clarity Press.
Okay.
Incorporated. They can buy those books from them too. Or Barnes & Noble. Barnes & Noble sell them. So, I mean, everywhere.
Okay. Outstanding. Well, thank you so much for your analysis and sharing time with us today. We wish you safety and blessings in the times ahead. Hopefully, we can all get through this with our families intact and maybe our nations intact if it all goes well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. For those of you watching, I hope you enjoyed that interview. I found it truly fascinating. Andrei is a brilliant man who has offered extensive analysis. You can find many of his videos also online with other channels such as The Duran or with Brian Berletic, The New Atlas, and others. I encourage you to check those out. And thank you for watching today here on Brighteon.com. Feel free to repost this video on other channels and other platforms as well. And get ready, folks, because interesting times are now upon us. Thank you for watching. God bless you all. Take care. Thank you for all your support of our platforms and healthrangerstore.com. And we have a new certified organic product that is very practical and important right now, given world events. It is a certified organic version of our nascent iodine. Here it is, Nascent Atomic Iodine, our Groovy Bee brand. And it's made with certified organic glycerin. So, of course, iodine itself, being an element, can't be organic or inorganic. I mean, the organic certification doesn't make sense when talking about just an element, just iodine. But the glycerin, which is the bulk of what's in this product, and it makes it very delicious to taste, by the way. It's You know, iodine can be pretty harsh when it's in alcohol, and iodine itself can taste, you know, pretty wild. In this glycerin format, at the right concentration, and it's organic glycerin, it's very easy to take. People love this formulation, and it's also easy for children to take, and even where appropriate for animals to, you can mix it in with their food very easily in this way. No alcohol, and the glycerin is all organic. So this is the nascent atomic iodine formulation, available now at healthrangerstore.com. Here's the three pack. We've got it available in different quantities. And believe me, as things start to really pop off in the Middle East, everybody's going to want to have the additional protection of iodine for, you know, thyroid support, among other purposes. And I use iodine for a number of applications, including I use it topically, but I use the alcohol version for topical applications. This with the glycerin is best for oral ingestion. Just use it as directed. Iodine is a heavy element, which means you can overdose on it. So don't go chugging bottles of iodine. That would be crazy. It's always a good idea to check with your naturopathic practitioner of how much iodine is appropriate for you. Maybe they can check your levels and determine how much that you need on an ongoing basis. It's not much. It's, you know, micrograms per day, technically, is all that a human being needs in terms of iodine. But if you're not getting it from other sources, i.e., if you're not eating a lot of seaweed, then you're probably not getting much iodine in your diet, like Japanese do, because they eat so much seaweed, they get a lot of natural iodine. But for most of us, we don't get much. Even the iodized salt is only given enough iodine to just barely prevent obvious diseases caused by iodine deficiency. So iodine supplementation can be very, very beneficial. And this is the first form we've ever had available that is the nascent atomic iodine in a certified organic, USDA organic format. And it's also lab tested in our laboratory to make sure it doesn't contain heavy metals, glyphosate, microbiology. I don't even see how microbes could live in this substance, by the way. But we do all the testing, so we have all the internal lab certifications for safety in addition to all the label claims and the organic certification as well. So check it out at healthrangerstore.com. Get yourself prepared. This will be a really powerful barter item as well, depending on what takes place next in the Middle East or elsewhere, maybe involving Russia, who knows. This will be a very valuable barter item to have, probably better than cash, at least for anybody who knows the value of iodine. And we will be completely blown out of this when events start to happen. We don't price gouge, so we're not going to like make the price 10 times higher as some operators do. Instead, we'll just sell everything at the same current price, but it'll be sold out very, very quickly, and it'll be a long time before we'll be able to get additional iodine, you know, once world events take place. We may never get iodine, depending on what happens. We'll see. We'll do our best to bring it to you. But thank you for your support. Again, healthrangerstore.com.